Motorcycle Man.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to episode 114 of the Motorcycle Men podcast. I am Ted here in the V-Twin Cafe, once again in a corner booth located in sunny downtown Cranford, New Jersey. So thank you very much for listening in and tuning into the show, and of course for listening to all of the Motorcycle Men episodes. If you would like to help out the show, you can do so by going to our website at motorcyclemen.us, and there you can click on the donate button if you'd like to help us out with a singular PayPal donation. Those of you who were on Patreon will know that we have canceled our Patreon page and our Patreon subscribers. It just wasn't working out for us, so we decided to cancel that. Another way you can help us out is if you want some feedback. Go over to iTunes and give us a rating, good, bad, or indifferent. We don't mind. Doesn't care. We'll accept any kind of feedback you want to give us. And while you're at it, you can send us an email to motomenpc@gmail.com, or you can simply go to our contact page on the website, motorcyclemen.us, and you can send us a note there. I read all of our emails, and if it's clever enough, we'll even read it during one of our podcasts. And you can also get on our mailing list, and you'll be the first to know when a new episode is out. Also, we have our new host of the podcast now, the site that's now hosting our podcast to give us better stats. They also have a feature now where you can actually listen to the podcast on your smartphone, and links will be available for that right here in show notes. Okay. Now, as you know, I have this fascination with those folks that have the opportunity to travel the world by motorcycle. I cannot even begin to explain how amazing and wondrous I find that to be. All of these folks have fantastic stories and memories that they're just waiting to share with everybody. And having interviewed authors like Jeremy Craker and Sam Manicom and, of course, Charlie Borman, you can get a sense from these people of what the experience must be like. So today, I have yet another World Motorcycle Traveler on the show who joins the ranks of those just mentioned. From the movie Somewhere Else Tomorrow, Mr. Daniel Rintz joins me here in the V-Twin Cafe. One little note before the interview begins. This was recorded remotely, not in my usual studio, so my audio may sound a little strange, but it is still listenable. Thank you very much. Now we get to the interview.
Joining me now, all the way from Dresden, Germany, I guess the star, you could say, of Somewhere Else Tomorrow, our new friend here at the Motorcycle Man Podcast, Daniel Rintz. How are you doing, sir?
Very well, thank you. Very good. How are you?
I am doing fine. How's the weather over there?
Oh, it's been great today. We've had some rainy days, but today is great, sunny, nice and warm.
Excellent. Did you ride today?
No, actually, I came back from a long drive today. I went to give a presentation in the far west in Germany last night.
So no riding today?
No riding, just driving, which is not as much fun. But if you want to cover 600 miles, then, you know, in one day, it's easier to drive.
Well, yeah, you can do it on motorcycle if you like.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I've just come back from a long, long trip, 3 years, and we've ridden almost every day. So I'm not like super, super desperate to get on the bike and ride everything, you know. Just have to go from A to B. It's fine too.
All right. Well, let's talk about.
I want to keep.
Tell us a little bit about your motorcycle self and the film Somewhere Else Tomorrow.
I made the film 2012 to 13, which is about a trip around the world. I was supposed to go, but I didn't make it all the way in one go because I met someone special. But the way it started, it was in 2008, a friend and myself out of university came up with the idea to just travel around the world and leave, you know, the desk jobs and the computer screens and all that behind. And because we were had been studying, we didn't have any money, any funding for it. So we thought we'd just work along the way, random jobs, and just try to stay afloat that way. And yeah, that's how I, that's what the first film is about. Basically, my buddy realized it's a cool idea, it's a fun idea, but there was more to it. And he met someone as well, but he met someone right in that period before we left for the trip, but after we made the decision to go.
Mm-hmm.
So for a couple of months, he stuck it out, and then he realized his girl was more important, so he turned around.
Okay.
And I continued for another 2 years on my own.
So now, tell us a little bit more about your inspiration to take this awesome journey.
It was actually unearthed by my buddy, who then turned around. He we met at university, and before I went to study, I went on a couple of extensive trips around South America, Northern Africa, Australia. I tried all kinds of transport. I tried bicycle, camper van. I backpacked and bought cheap cars in various places and sold them again. And I love motorcycling as well. So when he and I became friends in uni, he would always ask me about my trips. He just loved hearing the stories from on the road. And then just before we graduated, he proposed to go on a trip, and he didn't have the motorcycle license, and he didn't have a bike either. But I said, well, if we're gonna go on a trip, it's gonna be a bike. It's gonna be on bikes. And so yeah, I got a bike and a license, and we left.
Now, so you started out with your companion, and what was his name again?
Lars.
So early on, so he decided not to continue. Now, tell us how that changed the dynamic of your trip.
Once he left.
Yes.
Okay. It's true to say that it was his idea, but maybe I can go further back and say why.
Sure.
I like to travel, and I think it's got a lot to do with the fact that I grew up in Eastern Germany, which made it really nearly impossible to travel any place, really.
Okay.
Outside the our own country, maybe one or two neighboring countries, and then even if you wanted to go to Moscow or someplace that far, it would be very difficult. And as soon as the Iron Curtain came down, I mean, I just had to go out. I was curious about how the world worked, and when my friend came up with the idea, let's travel around the whole world, I was like, yeah, no question, I'm in. You know, let's do it. So I guess that's my background there for the traveling.
So then he departs.
Yeah.
And now you're riding by yourself.
Right. Yes.
How did
that change? Yeah. Right. You know, a lot of people ask me about that time when he decided to turn around, and he asked me as well. He said, you know, what are you going to do? I mean, I feel really bad about abandoning you or abandoning the idea or our plan, but at this moment, we were like 6 months into the trip, and we had seen so much, and we've met so many cool people, and it's been so fun, and so really, really, I mean, everything you would out asked for. And I was no doubt, there was no question. I just, yeah, okay, no problem. I hear you. I'm fine. I'm just going to continue. Don't worry about me. Do what you're going to do. Yeah, no, I mean, the only downside was that we traveled around the Mediterranean, and we were in Egypt, and then it was a process, right? It wasn't like one day when he said, I'm going to go. So it was between Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Turkey, which you could travel through at the time. It was back in 2009. Now it's a completely different story. So he turned around, and I was facing Eastern Turkey, Iran, and Pakistan, which were some of the hotspots that we've been talking about planning the trip, and we weren't quite sure how to go through it, and how could we go around it, or what safety precautions we could undertake to go through there safely, because there were some problems going on. I mean, Pakistan is known for it's got bad, still to this day, bad media attention, suicide bombings, terrorist attacks, and kidnappings. A lot of kidnappings. They just catch people, foreigners, and then try to get money for weapons. And in Iran, at the same time, or just before I was about to go through, they had the elections going on, and that caused a huge turmoil in the country as well. So I wasn't really excited about going through these places on my own,
right.
But I was determined to at least try.
Now, did you guys plan on a specific duration of your journey, or did you go out knowing that it was going to be a lifelong thing? And did you have a route planned?
I had no idea that it would take, in the end, 6 years. at the very beginning, we said, well, let's do it in 1 year. 1 year seemed like a long time for us to do something like this. But we didn't know. We couldn't have known what we would let ourselves into, working along the road, finding the money, finding the jobs, connecting with the people. And that just, on one side, it makes you travel slow and get a real feel for a place and meet a lot of people. But on the other hand, it is there's a lot of travelers much faster than myself. So it is slow travel. And for the route, we just thought we'd go east, and then if we keep going east long enough, then we'll end up back where we started. That was as concrete as our route was.
That's pretty loose.
Yeah, pretty loose. Yeah, I mean, there were a couple of we did do some research, and there were a couple of countries that we knew the visas would be hard to get, so we got them in advance, right. And we tried to work these countries into our route. But it was very tentative, very, very rough, very, very loose, yeah.
Now, what motorcycle did you use for this trip, and how did that perform for you?
I used the R80 GS BMW from 1982. It's a pretty old bike. At the time of our departure, I already owned it for 15 years, so I knew about the bike. I could fix it, and it's performed really well. I mean, it's a cheap bike. It's pretty simple technology. I don't worry about whether I have the perfect bike for what I do too much. I mean, it's a good all-rounder, but I have seen guys on 125 Vespa scooters going from Paris to Vietnam. I've seen guys on an R1 race bike travel around the world. I have met people on all kinds of bikes. It's all possible. It's just what you want, right? Mm. And I thought the Beamer, the old Beamer, it'd do the job. It'd be good off-road, on-road, comfortable enough. Yeah. So it's worked for me.
Oh, well, knowing what you know now, do you wish you had picked a different bike?
Well, if I had more money, the newer bike, so I'd not have to work as much on it. But it's all part of the fun, right?
Sure.
I mean, and it didn't break. I mean, it only broke down once where I had to really work on it right away. I just stopped. Basically, I couldn't continue driving it. All the other times, it was minor problems where I could just keep riding. You know, a head bearing, you kind of become aware of it wearing out, and then you have a couple thousand miles before you really have to do something about it, you know, these kind of things. So that happened all the time.
Wow.
But the one time in Pakistan, the final drive, I think it was the universal joint of the drive shaft that broke, so that put me to a stop. That was the only time, but I'm grateful for it.
Yeah. Did you use a GPS or maps?
I used a GPS and I hated it. I hated it so much.
Really?
Yeah. Oh God. I hate GPSs. I think I don't know what they're doing. TomTom, Garmin. I don't know what's wrong with them. They just lost the plot. I think I started riding around the world before smartphones. Or, hang on, no, 2008, the iPhone just came out, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think if you buy a $80 or $100 smartphone and put an app on there like Maps.me or any of those offline routing maps, you'll be way better off navigating your way around the world than with any GPS.
Really?
Because, yeah, I mean, GPSs are just horrible to work with. It takes like 2 hours to get one address in because you have to, you know, have one button to do it. And even with the touchscreen ones, the expensive ones, I met someone along the road and they had one with a touchscreen. It doesn't work with the gloves well, and even with your fingers, you have to kind of make almost scratch the screen in order to. It's not really responsive. I don't know. Just a cheap smartphone. If you lose it, buy another one. It's still cheaper than buying a GPS. But having said that, paper maps are underrated.
I hear.
What I do though, I don't carry them because they're, you know, you probably need one per country. And then you barely ever, especially because you're on a bike, you don't have a bonnet. What do you say, hood in America, right? Yeah. Of car where you spread out the map and then look at it. And then it's always windy. So basically a large paper map is not really handy out when you're out and about. So what I do is I hang it up on the wall and I flatten it and I make sure that it's good lighting on it. And I take a good photograph, a high resolution photograph, or even several photographs, and then stitch them together to make one big file with a lot of pixels so I can zoom in like a lot.
Oh, there you go. That's
and then
smart.
I put it on my phone. Yeah. And then I can just use it and zoom in, and I can even convert it into a PDF. And with the PDF, you can have little notes at certain places, or right. You can highlight a certain route in different colors. You can draw in it. You make, you know, you show it to other people. You talk about it, and you don't need a lot of space, right? You don't need the whole hood to spread your map out.
Sure.
And you can do it. You can use it when it's windy as well.
Wow.
So
excellent.
So yeah, that's what I do.
When people talk about taking a trip like this, one of the first things that comes into everybody's mind: how am I going to fund this? How is this going to be? I want to pay for this upfront, be all set to go. But you took a different route. You took this journey with absolutely no budget at all. So tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, as I said earlier, we didn't have the funds. That changed the way we traveled. But I think it isn't. I mean, we were young and it was fun. We didn't know it would work, but we tried, and it was very hard in the beginning, but the more we worked on our network and the more people knew about us traveling, the easier it became, you know. Sometimes or later on, even after Lars left, when I arrived somewhere in some place, someone else who I had worked for already told someone else, and then they would pick me up, and it was easier the further in we went. But it was a challenge, a constant battle. It was never too much money, right?
So
I always lived like right on the edge of survival. But people, wherever you go in the world, people draw to when they see a traveler on a shoestring budget, they're like intrigued. They want to hear about your story, and
really?
They try to find a way to help you. And that's very true anywhere in the world. So and I never said no, right? Whenever there was a job offer, as long as it was legal and it had nothing to do with prostitution or drugs or weapons, I would say yes, I'd do it. I would be washing dishes for like $1 an hour. I didn't care, because more often than not, the simple, basic, not so well paid job would then help me make connections, right? So I'd be dishwashing in this restaurant, and then I'd be talking to the chef, and the chef said, well, it's really cool what you do, I like your story, can you come mow my lawn, and you earn some money that way, and then you do that. And then someone walks by with a dog and says, what are you doing, you don't look like from around here, and you get talking, and he owns a media company, and you sell a newspaper article about your journey and some photographs.
Yeah.
And it goes on, you know, people read about it, they email you, and, you know, things happen. It's really cool.
That's awesome. Now, you'd also do some freelance work online, though, don't you?
That would make about half of my income is working over the internet for clients that I have back in Germany or all over Europe, some in the US and Canada as well, Asia, Australia. People that I've known from the past, or I've worked for before. So yeah, that's a good,
so good that way your for trip me as well. To,
yeah, that would help. Yeah.
Did you find it difficult to earn your way from place to place at all?
Well, it was never easy, but it was always enough to keep going.
Oh, good.
Sometimes I was stationary and just had to figure something out, and I worked underground. I asked around, but I never got stuck and said, "Well, shit, I have to go fly home." It never happened. No. It was always enough to just have a little bit in my tank and a little bit of food in my pocket and keep going. Yeah,
all right.
Always worked.
Where was the bulk of your expense, though? Was it your food, fuel, lodging, your supplies, repairs?
It depends. In some countries, some things are more expensive than others, and then depending on whether you are in a Western country or in a developing country. But I think food is one of the bigger ones. You have to eat, right? And when you travel as much as I do, well, at least for me, I mean, people are very adventurous with food and they eat anywhere. I'm quite conservative when it comes to food. I'd be happy with some plain pasta, mm-hmm. rather than try eat at the roadside kind of food stand with, you know, some meat that's been on the grill for a day or two. I don't know. So I'm really careful.
I understand completely.
So food is a little bit... is a bigger one that costs some money. And then accommodation, you can't wild camp all the time, especially if you have found a job and you work for people. You want to come clean and showered, show up in the morning, and
sure.
So you have accommodation. That is another one. Fuel is also it's not that big, because I ride a lot of times, but it's not, I mean, if a lot of people in the US or even in Europe, they commute just as much every day as I would, like, on average, right?
Sure.
I've been traveling 6 years, and if you take all the kilometers and all miles I've traveled, it's a number that a lot of people just are happy to commute every day. You know, I don't ride every day, but then I have days where I do 500-600 miles, right? But it's not too big. Fuel is not that too much.
So now, in watching the movie, the worst part, I think, was when your bike broke down. It was in Iran, I believe. At the time, how much fear and danger did you feel that put you in? And do you think you'd feel the same way today?
It was, I think it started in Iran, but I dismissed it. I dismissed the symptoms. Where I really broke down, it was Pakistan. Just across the border into Balochistan. It's a desert area. It's about 50 miles from the Afghanistan border.
Okay.
And I was with an escort at the time. Not the pretty ladies one, the compulsory, the mandatory military escort.
Okay.
The people, they won't let you travel on your own in that region because it's too dangerous. What I read in the newspaper just a couple of weeks before I entered Pakistan was that a French guy was kidnapped right along my route. And where the bike stopped working, that was right where that happened. Maybe, I don't know, what, one village down, basically.
Perfect timing.
Perfect timing. I mean, if I felt, how did I feel? I mean, I was very worried, very concerned about going through Pakistan. I planned to ride through it in 4 days. I said, I'm going to ride 12 hours a day. I'm only going to stop for fuel and food,
mm-hmm.
and just going to ride, and then make it into India, where, you know, it's more democratic, it's much safer, supposedly. But this didn't work. And the escort guys, they were like, oh, that's not good. We kind of are responsible for this guy here. And but they helped. And how did I feel? It's weird. I mean, I was in before I entered Pakistan, I was really nervous. But when it happened, I automatically switched into survival mode. I wasn't like panicking or anything. Mm-hmm. I just said, okay, well, how do I deal with this? How do I get out of it? What needs to be done? And in hindsight, I'm really grateful for that incident, because it forced me to stay much longer than I intended. Instead of the 4 days, I ended up staying for 6 weeks, I think.
Wow.
6 or 7 Yeah. You know, there's no BMW dealer with ball bearings. Imagine that in the whole country. But because of the incident, I got a good feel for the people and how respectful they actually are. And it only takes a few crazy ones or extremists to screw up a reputation for the whole country, right?
Oh,
I met so many fantastic people. And I actually extended my trip. I said, okay, well, after four or five weeks, I managed to find the interim solution that fixed the bike. And I decided, well, I like this place so much. I traveled up the Karakoram Highway up to the border of China. And I came back down and I crossed into India through the Lahore border. Mm-hmm. And I'm grateful. I'm happy for the bike breaking down, because otherwise I would have brought myself, or I would have never had the experience that
sure.
I had.
So, you would have drove right by all of that.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I would have just left with the same prejudice that I had before. But,
okay.
You know, I learned more.
Now, you had a chance to go yeah. over the world's highest paved road, or highest mountain pass. Is that correct?
Let me think. You know, the jury is still out on this. The Indians say they're like pretty sure it is the highest motorable mountain pass in the world in northern India.
Yes.
But there is Chileans and Argentinians or Bolivians that say we have higher mountain passes in the Andes. And I wrote there too. You know, I mean, I can't keep track of all these numbers, and then they try to cheat. I don't know. But it was pretty high. It was pretty high. The bike was down to maybe 30-40% of its actual power air. So, yeah, and walking was difficult. So it was high. Yeah,
wow.
It was
very high. So this journey seemed to be more about the people along the way. Was the motorcycle adventure part of it just as much of an impact on you?
Well, I chose the motorcycle intentionally because of the people. I like motorcycling, but it's not the main reason why I motorcycle. It's because when I traveled in a camper van in Africa and other places, it's fantastic because you can carry more food, more water, more supplies. You can go more remote areas.
Mm-hmm.
But when you come through cities, areas, regions that you don't really feel so sure about.
Yeah.
You watch everything through your windscreen, like watching TV. You don't stop, you don't pull over, you don't interact with the people.
Yeah.
And I noticed this about myself. I was driving my own little comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
And the motorcycle doesn't let you do this. When
right.
you stop, and you flip open your helmet, you're already immersed. You're right in the middle of it. So I wanted to do this and to have this experience where you're like in the middle of it. And also the people perceive you in a different way. When you rock up with a fully outkitted 4x4 super van, I don't know, truck, then they will not get up from the seat to see, you know, if you're okay. But if you pull up on an old motorcycle and you've got all this luggage on the back and you look different and just very interesting to them, right? And they're curious. And then before you know it, you're like in the middle of whatever's going on in that place.
Well, I get the impression that must have happened a lot to you.
All the time. Yeah, it's the easiest icebreaker. It's a very good icebreaker being on a bike. Everyone around the world is interested in motorcycles. I don't know why. I mean, I love it. I thought about why motorcycling is such a big deal for me, but then maybe it's because it's the most reduced, the most basic form of transportation with an engine.
Yes.
Right? There's nothing on a bike you don't need. It's just two wheels and engine, and it propels you forward. And that's just, it's just so, it's fun. You know, you feel the road, you have to lean in, you have to work with your body, and you feel the temperature and the wind, and It's just it's raw.
Well, it's more intimate, for one. So when you look back on all of the things of that journey, what memories do you recall the most? And the interaction with the people, or was it the motorcycle segments, or was it a combination of the two?
I think it was a combination.
Yeah.
The motorcycle opened up a lot of doors, but then when it comes down to actual experience, it's the people almost all the time. It's learning about other people's lives and their perspectives and their stories and let me think about some of the highlights. One very general highlight was for me Southeast Asia in Laos. It's landlocked between Thailand, Vietnam, and Myanmar, and I think it's very personal. I mean, I don't see how it's got almost no tourism, but the few people that have been to Laos, they might have a completely different experience. There. But when I came to Laos, I just traveled across the Himalayas, the highest mountain range in the world, and it was winter, and I had no choice but do it at that time. In that certain way, because China was still is close to individual travelers on motorcycles or cars, so it's very difficult to get your own vehicle in. And I had to group up with a bunch of people in order to just travel any further. For the longest time, India seemed to be like a dead end for my journey. I couldn't get through Burma. I was like really stuck. So I had a really tough time traveling across all these high mountains in the winter. It was super cold. It was icy. And all the other people in the group, they were in cars. So they would travel 6 hours a day. But because I was on two wheels and it was so slippery, it took me 12 hours to do the same distance.
Wow.
And there was no room for, any delay, because the Chinese government wanted to know when... they were checkpoints, and we had to register with all the checkpoints. We had a 24-hour guide. There was no room for, okay, well, just take another day. And I got food poisoning, and I was really weak. And because of the weakness, I had altitude sickness. We're around 14,000 to 17,000 feet for a couple of weeks, with no break in between. So I was like, I was really, really exhausted and depleted when I reached Laos. And that is probably why Laos had such a big impact on me. It is a Buddhist country, and everything is pretty zen and mellow and easy, and people are really kind and nice, and this whole vibe kind of resonated with me, and I stayed a long time there. And that was one of the highlights where something happened to me, like in a bigger way. The journey had been going on for 2 years at that time, and I realized I guess I found out who I was, because being on the road for a few years, I was like, I'm doing what I want to do most, and that I wasn't able to say this very often before that point in my life. And that was a huge highlight for me, which is not connected to a particular person or a group of people. But that was just one that came to mind.
Well, it's a learning experience, that's for sure. You'll definitely get to know who you are and the things that affect you the most. So now tell us about meeting Joey. How did that change the adventure for you?
Oh, that changed everything. of course. She sent me an email. I think I was in India at the time, or Nepal or someplace. And we had a mutual friend. And this mutual friend mentioned to her that I was going to be traveling in Southeast Asia at the time when Joey planned to go and backpack around that Thailand, Cambodia or something. That was her plan. And so our mutual friend suggested to get in touch so we can go for a cup of coffee or something. And I was like, oh yeah, okay, I remember. Yeah, I've seen you at parties, right? Let's try. I have other problems to take care of now, which is, for one, was trying to get out of India, yeah. which I managed in the end. And so I made it there in time, right? I think it was 3 months later, I made it there. I went to the airport ready to pick her up because I'm a nice guy. So, but she doesn't show up. So I go back to the hostel. I sit in my dorm. I go online and see what she's doing. And she sent me an email. I can't fly because this volcano in Iceland went off, and there's no flights all over Europe. Everything grounded. Nothing moves. For 1 week, everything was down. And the only reason why I went to Bangkok was to meet her. So I had nothing to do, and she had nothing to do because she already told all her friends she'd be gone, right? So right. We sat there talking on Skype for the time being. What do you want to do in Southeast Asia? Okay, what is your trip like? Blah, blah, blah. So we got to know each other. And before you know it, you know, the day before she could fly out, we were like on Skype for 9 hours straight.
Are you serious?
Which is... Yeah, so
oh my God.
Yeah, this Skype interview with you right now, that is a piece of cake. just 1 hour, nothing. Yeah, it was crazy. I mean, there was something there, right? And when she got there, I picked her up. You know, I mean, we did not lose too many words about where we should go or whether we should travel together in the first place.
Right.
I just dropped half my gear. I left it in the hostel in Bangkok so I could make some room for her on the bike. She strapped her backpack on and off we went. We traveled all the time that she had on a trip, 3 or 4 months. We traveled Cambodia, Vietnam, Laos, Thailand.
Wow.
All over. Wow. And there was no discussion like, where do you want to go? Or do you want to go? You want to come along? Or should we go? Should we meet somewhere or something? No, it's just, let's go.
Wow. You you said you left half of your gear at the hostel in Bangkok. So when you said you left it there, did you just abandon this gear? Or did you sell it? Did you ship it back home?
Oh, no. I just talked to the hostel owner. I said, can I leave one big bag in storage? And they said, yeah, for... X amount of money. And oh. I said, how about half? And I said, okay.
is it still there?
We did a loop. Oh. We traveled in a loop. So when I dropped her off at the airport, I picked up my stuff and I continued. And it was the best time. And, you know, I've never been with anyone for 24 hours, 7 days a week, 4 months straight. And by the time she had to go back and I dropped her off at the airport, it was like, gee, I mean, we need to do this again. there needs to be more of this.
No. Why did she have to leave? Did she have to go back to work or something? Or is that why she left? Or she had enough?
She had commitments career-wise. She couldn't just hop on and continue to travel with me. But as soon as she got back, we looked into ways of coming back together, and we made it happen. A couple of months later, she came down to Australia. She did an internship, which worked with her career, and I worked a little bit. So we spent some time there, and then we traveled to New Zealand, mm-hmm. which is basically the halfway point of my around the world motorcycle circumnavigation. Mm-hmm. And I decided, okay, well, this girl is more important than my trip, so I'll just take a break and we'll figure something out. And we both went back. We talked about it, but there was never a question about whether we will finish what I started. It was like an unspoken rule. Yes, okay, we'll work something out. I'll take a break, but I want to finish my trip around the world, and you're going to be part of it.
Okay.
And so that's what happened.
Wow. So you concluded the first part of your trip in New Zealand. And so the mm-hmm. decision to stop there was basically Joey, correct?
Absolutely.
And did you continue with the journey?
Yes. We spent 3 years in Germany. I used the time to make this movie, Somewhere Else Tomorrow, mm-hmm. we talked about.
Yes.
which really helped us with the second part of the trip, because people seemed to like it a lot, and it went on iTunes and Amazon Prime and onto a couple of TV channels in Europe, which gave us pocket money for gas money for the second part of the trip.
Right.
And while I made the movie, Josephine got her license for the bike and the motorcycle, and we did some practice runs, and then we shipped them to New York in order to do North, Central, South America, and also Africa.
Wow.
On the way home.
You two are on this other new adventure that you're doing. So why don't you tell us about that trip?
We just came back this summer from, we rode up the western route of Africa, and we only decided to do Africa after we reached our actual destination, Ushuaia, in Argentina,
mm-hmm.
After having ridden the entire length of the Americas. We shipped the bikes to New York in 2014, and at that time we were back to our old theme, which is, you know, two wheels, one world, zero money. We did the same thing. We worked along the way, because the break we took in Germany, basically me working on the movie, I did a few freelance jobs on the side, but basically Josephine's job had to take care of both of us.
Right.
So we had little savings, but then we had to ship the bikes over, we had to pay for our flights, we had to pay health insurance, worldwide coverage for 2 years up front.
Wow.
And there were a bunch of costs right at the beginning. So when we arrived in New York and mm-hmm. had the bikes over, got on the bikes, that was pretty much zero money again, and we worked along the way.
Wow.
As well. And we made it all the way up to the northernmost motorable point in Alaska, Dead Horse, Kudu Bay, and then all the way down to Argentina. It took us 2 years, and then Africa another year.
Did you find it easier or harder to make money in the U.S.?
I think the U.S. is great because people are really open, and they draw to a great story. So we were... Oftentimes, people would just approach us and say, "Hey, guys, I saw your plates. Where are you guys from?" And then you get talking, and because there's, you know, the language barrier also is not so much of an issue. I mean, Josephine speaks Spanish, but in Northern America, it was really cool to connect with people and find jobs and work the network. That was really cool. In Central and South America, we managed to find some jobs on the ground as well. A couple of times we made films for, like, short image films for the places we stayed in, right? So we looked for, most of the times we stayed in budget hostels, cheap places, or camped out in the wild. But every now and so often, right, you want to stay in a nicer place. So we talk to them, say, "Look, I've looked at your website. It seems like you don't have like a nice video to showcase all your nice rooms and everything. So we are filmmakers. Why don't you let us help you with this?" So we earned a little bit of money that way, or got some free accommodation.
Oh, that's good.
And there were other ways to, yeah, it all helps. All helps. There were some ways. It was easy enough.
With regard to traveling through the Americas, was there a little bit of culture shock in comparison to traveling through Europe and Southeast Asia?
I mean, I know what culture shock is, both ways, going to an exotic place and also coming back and then looking at your own society and like or culture and like, oh wow, that's kind of strange to me now, but because I've exercised this so many times, on so many trips, right, we kind of knew that the scene changes as you go along. So it wasn't something that registered with us too much. We were like after different experiences. Yeah.
Was traveling through South America any more difficult with regard to the road travel?
Well, it depends. If you want, you can stay on tarmac and good roads all the way down to the most southern point. But if you're adventurous and if you want to, you know, go off the beaten path and go to the small villages, there is some great challenges that you can take. It's fantastic. You can do either way, and it. I loved Central and South America. Traveling there is really cool. Nice. Riding is fantastic. The Andes offer just beautiful scenery and crazy roads with steep cliffs and gravel roads and dangerous. Yeah.
Did you get to go over that other higher pass?
A bunch of them, yes.
Oh, okay.
I didn't. I think there's one place which is just go up and come down. It's not a mountain pass. It's like a, I think it's a volcano in Bolivia.
Okay.
Which is very high, but it's very remote to get to. We rode around that area. They call it the Laguna Route. It leads you from the largest salt flat in Bolivia, and it's the largest salt flat in the world, Salar de Uyuni, it's called. You go south from there, and it's a couple of days of just nothing. There's no villages, there's no water. There's some lagunas, but it's not potable. You can't drink the water. It's salty. There's flamingos in it, and some of the lakes there, they change color. Depending on the angle of the sun, so throughout the day, it's really magical. And then the volcanoes in the background, and really, really cool. But I did not go to that particular high place. I wasn't looking for superlatives to take off. And so, didn't do that.
So, are we going to be seeing another movie?
I hope so. I'm at the moment. We have a crowdfunding running. It's going till November 10th this year, which we're basically trying to get funding for the post-production.
Okay.
The production is finished. We've captured all the footage. We have tons of footage. We have great stories. We've met fantastic people, great interviews. It's a lot there, and of a lot of different places as well, right? But it's not cheap to get the post-production underway.
Sure.
I can do most of it. I can do a lot of editing, which takes a lot of pressure off. But there are certain things that need to be covered. So we're asking individuals, travel fans, to come in, look at our website, and basically buy the movie now.
Mm-hmm.
Or by November 10th, and with the funding, we will make the post production happen, and then when the movie is finished, we'll send it to them.
Okay,
and that's worked beautifully last time with the first film. We've done it the same way as well. We used Indiegogo for that, and at the moment, I think we're at 65%.
There you go.
Of the funding,
we're getting there.
We're not too far away. Yeah,
no, not at all.
And yeah.
All right.
Yeah, that's the plan. So if you can reach our funding goal, then there'll be another movie.
Excellent. Now, you did all the filming yourself, correct?
Yes.
Wow. So you got to carry some gear with you then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We even carried a drone for not the entire length of the trip, but I think late 2014, we approached a drone manufacturer, and they love what we do. And they wanted some footage, and they sent us a drone and their extra batteries and all the things. And that was fun. That added another little. I mean, we have so much stuff. Seriously, it's not just the cameras. You also have to carry microphones and backup. Hard drives and cables and chargers and batteries and laptops and laptop cases.
And that's weight.
It just adds up, right?
That's all weight.
It's
too.
A lot of weight.
Yeah.
All weight, yeah. And I could easily travel on a 250 if just me and my iPhone. a few pictures. Easy, It's but all the gear, it adds up quickly, right?
Oh, sure. So now tell us, how can people follow you and learn more about your adventures?
Well, the easiest way is to jump onto our website. It's www.open-exploros.com. And Josephine put a lot of work into keeping our travel blog alive. She is the one who took a lot of photographs, because my camera, when I was out and about, my camera was always set to video, and I was the guy capturing everything in motion pictures.
Right.
And Josephine was taking still pictures. So there's a lot of fantastic. I think she's a fantastic photographer. There's a lot of fantastic photographs on our blog and a lot of stories. So we have this map on our website, and on the map you'll find little dots with a connecting line, and you can basically click along our travel route and read the stories, navigate from one story to another using the map. That is one way to learn about our trip, and our website is probably the best to start with.
All right, for a final question, for those would-be travelers out there who have dreamt of doing such an adventure, what advice would you give them?
How many tips? Just one?
As many as you have.
How much time do you have? All right, just you. If you think about doing it, I would suggest just set a date that you think it's feasible to be prepared by, and then tell everyone, that's the date I'm going to leave. Because that way, you don't end up endless preparing. Just preparing, never doing it, right?
Oh, yeah,
never,
I can see how that could happen, yes.
Yeah, a lot of people do this, right? And just from my experience, when I decided to do it, that moment, that was the scariest moment of the entire trip. Everything that came after, all the 6 years, all the miles and miles of riding and the crazy traffic and the corrupt police and the crazy border crossings and dropping the bike and getting bogged down, everything, all that is by far not as scary as the moment as making the decision. So just be aware of that. When you decide to do it, you're almost there.
Okay.
So that'd be my advice. Just do it. And also, don't worry about your bike. Just take the one you have. Doesn't matter. It's got two wheels, it runs, use it, take it. Don't over prepare, because everyone I know over prepares. And especially if you haven't traveled before or traveled extensively before, it's very easy to try, because I did it, it's easy to try and overcompensate with all the gadgets and things you think you might need, but you don't need anything really. People will help you, and if you need something, you'll be able to purchase it where you need it. Mm-hmm. That's a golden rule.
Well, Daniel, I want to thank you very much for joining me here on the podcast to talk about your trip. Have safe travels in the future.
Thank you so much.
And please keep in touch.
Thanks for having me. Will do, for sure.
Thank you for listening to this episode 114 with Daniel Rince of Somewhere Else Tomorrow Movie. You can check that out on Amazon. It's available there. And you can also learn more about Daniel and his travels. You can go to www.open-explorers.com. So do that. Check that out. Find out what's going on. And watch the movie. It really is a great movie. I'm going to give a review of that very shortly. Don't forget to check out our fellow podcasters, like Loud Pipes and Throttle Podcast, Motorcycles and Misfits, Cleveland Moto, Cafe Racer Podcast, and the Wheel Nerds. These guys, and there's a whole bunch more motorcycle podcasts out there that will suit your flavor. A lot of these guys, they're very technical. They know their shit. Unlike us, we're not technical guys, as you know. We're just crazy, stupid Harley guys. But what do you want? Anyway, so go check them out. And remember, and also you got Del Boy's Garage YouTube channel. And there's a lot of other motorcycle-related YouTube channels out there that you need to check out. One of my new favorites now is Dan the Fireman. So he's got some really cool videos. He's got the Sportster that I turned into a scrambler, and it's badass. So check that out. Now, as you know, we did make the changes to the podcast and website, and our website is going to be reduced to minimal content, and we'll not have the podcasts available there. There will be a link from the website to the new location of the podcast and the RSS feed. That's going to change. That new location is it's going to be in the show notes, so you can check that out rather than me trying to blab it off, because it's a lot of numbers and letters, and I get confused easy. You know me. There will not be a podcast next week. I am going to be on vacation up at my farm in upstate New York, but we will be back in the studio for a new show for our Halloweeny episode on the 31st, and we're going to go over some really funny stuff for Halloween. I will have some mini episodes coming at you in the weeks to come. This is going to be a little new thing I'm going to be doing. These new mini episodes will spotlight some gear reviews, audiobook and movie reviews and such, all of which, of course, are motorcycle related. All right, so be looking forward to that coming to you very shortly. All right, so from Timbuktu, Chris the Joker, and me, Ted Wrongway, your host, thank you for listening to the Motorcycle Men podcast, where we say stupid crap so you don't have to. Enjoy your ride, kids.